views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and we are going to really lighten up this show. I've been doing a lot of dark shows lately, so today we're going to be doing a much brighter, feel-good show. We are going to be talking about after-death experiences. It is a much brighter show. It sounds like it might not be. It's about death, but it's really an amazing show. We are going to be talking with Roberta Grimes. She's been studying this stuff for over 50 years. And before we get into that, I'm going to tell you some of the research that's out there. The science and the research is really growing in this area. And a lot of the people who are doing the research are doctors and nurses. They experience the death of people, and they see these amazing things that go on, and they talk to their patients, and they know that there's more going on than what we realize. Some people think it's just chemical, the DMT chemical, and that's it, and it makes us see a light, and we feel really good. But a lot of emergency room doctors and doctors who are around people that die would say that just doesn't really make sense, because there are memories. When people, for example, when people come back from an experience, like they were able to revive this person for whatever reason that is, they have memories. And according to doctors, their brain is actually, there's no brain activity, but yet they still have memories. So they have absolutely no explanation for these things. They don't know why they know that. They can remember, they can even see what the doctors are doing on the table and what they're saying and what they're saying to each other. They have this out-of-body experience where they look down and they can watch. And they come back telling the doctors exactly what they're saying, what they're doing, but there was no brain activity. So they don't know why that's going on. From what doctors are saying, 7% of the people can be revived. And of that 7%, 20% in Western countries and 30% in Eastern countries have a near-death experience. And they're all very, very similar, where they go through these different phases. And Roberta Grimes is going to talk about a lot of this. But they all go through these different phases where eventually you get to this beautiful place of eternal love. They feel like they're all knowing, and they just this peaceful, amazing place. The people that do end up coming back, they're changed forever. They don't have fear of dying anymore. 98% do not have a fear of dying after that situation. They're more empathetic. They are more loving towards others. They're not into material things like they were before. Their whole life changes and their whole outlook. It's a really fascinating area. And like I said, the science in this area is really growing. So let's get into our interview now with Roberta Grimes. Like I said, she has over 50 years of research that she's done into this topic, and she has really come to some conclusions. It's a fun interview. Just listening to some of her ideas and what conclusions she came up with, it's different. It's a different paradigm. And it doesn't matter what you believe as far as religions and religious, but just to open your mind and listen to what she has is just a fun interview, and it makes you feel good. So let's get Roberta Grimes onto the show right now.
Hi, Roberta. Welcome to the program. I'm so glad to be with you. We're going to have so much fun today.
I think we are too. I've been really, this is one of the, you know, I usually bring on people that have innovation and disruption and the big issues, right? And I think you're in the category of maybe innovative and definitely disruptive, but it's also the it's also the category of just stuff Sarah's interested in. So,
well, that's good. Yeah. I think we all are on some level, but a lot of people are afraid to find out, and there's no need to be afraid. It's all good.
Well, okay. Well, let's get into some of these. You have developed a life passion for studying what happens at the point of death and after. Why do you think you've developed such a strong passion for this?
When I was 8 years old, I woke up in the middle of the night and I knew there was no God and I was terrified. And in the midst of my terror, there was a bright flash of white light in the room, and a voice said, "You wouldn't know what it is to have me if you didn't know what it is to be without me. I will never leave you again." Now, when you're 8, everything surprises you, and therefore I wasn't really surprised. I thought, oh, if you forget there's a God, they remind you, and I went back to sleep. But that kind of experience stays immediately in your mind. I never told anyone about it, but I wanted to know what that was. And I even majored in Christianity in college. I had to know what that was. And I had actually a similar experience at the age of 20 when I was so bummed out about having chosen religion as a college major. And so really, for the past 50 years, I've been trying to find out what happened to me when I was 8. And that led me to try to figure out where the dead are, because that's where I thought that experience had come from. And I was right. And then that led me to all the other stuff I'm doing now. It's all part of one great, wonderful whole.
Well, what happened when you were 20?
When I was 20, I came home from my summer job, sat down on my bed, and I was feeling terrible because I didn't know what to do with a religion major, and I knew, since I wasn't going to ask anybody, I thought, when you get to be expert at Christianity, they'll tell you what happens if you forget there's a God. I mean, talk about stupid, but that's what I thought at the time, and no one was telling me. So I was feeling very bummed. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, over my right shoulder, splashing in the room, is the same white light, this time with beautiful music, and the same voice said, "I will never leave you." That's all it said. So that's when that validated for me what I remembered from when I was 8. And that's what really started me on my quest to figure it all out.
So what did you do to figure it out? What type of research did you do, and how broad, you know, what did you study to come up with your conclusions that we're about ready to talk about?
Well, the problem was, this was in the 60s and there wasn't much information. I still have some books from then, and they're kind of pathetic books about ghosts and stuff. But in 1975, Raymond Moody published his wonderful Life After Life, which was where he coined the term near-death experiences. And that started an interest in the field of death. And there started to be books. And the great thing about books is they have bibliographies. And that's when I discovered that we have a treasure trove of information received in the latter part of the 19th and about the first 40 years of the 20th century. And I devoured as much as I could find of that material. And there's a lot of it. It's channeled material. A lot of it came through deep trance mediums, which is a much more advanced kind of mediumship than anyone is doing today, or nearly anyone. Most of it was received in the southern part of England and in the eastern United States, New York and Boston mainly. And wherever it was received and whenever it was received, if you read enough of it, you realize all these people are having the same experiences in the same places, but there are no duplicated stories. I've read hundreds of accounts from people who have died telling about what they're doing, where they are now. It's all the same. The physics, the way they dress, the process, the things their pastimes, all of it is the same. The way they travel, the way they communicate, it's all the same. So after about 10 years of reading this stuff, and again, I've got a day job, I've got a family, so I wasn't doing it all the time, and this was just my hobby. But I had to realize, that's real. This is real. I saw no outliers. Nobody said, "And everybody's purple," or nobody's, there was nothing different. They were all the same. So that's when I knew it was real. And the problem was that some of it was hard to understand, because For one thing, you travel by thought, and it's instantaneous. You'd like to go to Pluto? Oh, easy. You're there, just by thought. Every historical period is all happening in the same time and in the same place. In fact, there is no time in the same sense that we all sort of think of time. Communication is telepathic. It was the same, but it was weirdly different. And it was only really in the first part of this century that we began to get good quantum physics for dummies books, you know, that we could understand. There's no math. And that was when, I wasn't the only one, a number of researchers suddenly realized that it all makes sense. And the progress was very quick from then on to what we all know is true.
Well, how do you know yeah. that the experiences that you read weren't copied from each other? Were there people that you could identify and say, there's no way that they could have the same experience?
They weren't. I would have detected copying. Understand, I started this as a skeptic because I knew what had happened to me when I was 8 and again at 20 was real. And therefore, I didn't want any pablum, which is why I rejected the Christian and all religious notions right at the start, because they were based on beliefs. I wanted to know the truth. And I looked for copied material. I looked for, I've read about this place or this thing before. There were none. I detected no copying at all. And what was curious was that even though they were happening in different places, these people were dying in different places and talking to their relatives, you know, decades and decades apart, it was really all the same experience. The process that happens at and after death is remarkably consistent, I think, worldwide. That hasn't been researched, but it will be researched once scientists get a clue. But it appears to be a universal human experience, and it's really quite beautiful. It's a pity most people don't know what it is that happened.
Well, what do they experience?
Death is a process. As we approach death, and I should just say, we plan our lives, and they're planned as opportunities for spiritual growth. We plan two or three exit points into our lives, which we can, we don't consciously choose, but our higher consciousness says, okay, we've learned all we can in this lifetime, and we want to go home. Nobody wants to be here. And so we choose to leave then. And when the place that your higher consciousness has chosen as your exit point is approaching, either you're very sick or you're about to have an accident or something's going to happen which is going to take your life. And within about 24 hours of when you're actually going to die, and if you've been ill, it's a common thing, doctors know, that suddenly you'll be alert within, say, 24 hours before the death. They see that as a sign death is imminent. Suddenly you look like you're getting better, but you're not. You're actually, your consciousness is beginning to separate from your body. During this time, people who have end-stage Alzheimer's or are complete, they almost don't even have a brain left, will suddenly sit up in bed and start talking normally. This is a fairly common thing most people are not aware of. But what happens around that time is you also start to see people that you used to know that died, or even pets, sometimes one or two, sometimes a crowd. They often appear in the upper corners of the room and then come down and talk with you. They all look young, healthy, happy, and that's when you realize, hey, this is real. They survived, so I'm going to survive too, and it becomes fun. Most people stop talking to those at their deathbeds at that point. They're communicating. They'll often lie looking at a corner of the room, and they're really talking in their mind with the people who've come to get them. Steve Jobs, when he was within hours of death, was talking to his family, and all of a sudden he looked above their heads and he said, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow, and then he never spoke to them again. That's a typical kind of thing that happens. When it's time for you actually to die, people who have been awake during that process tell us that it's kind of a funny feeling because your consciousness starts to withdraw. You're made like Matryoshka dolls. You know, the nested energy bodies is all that you are. Everything is energy. Nothing is what we think of as solid. And the internal energy bodies are leaving, but this one that looks material is going to stay here. So it's as if you're sort of Velcroed in to your extremities. And so they say that it feels like little threads breaking as their energy gathers to get, you know, gets out of their fingers and hands and arms and feet and legs and gathers in their chest. Doesn't hurt, but it feels funny. And then they leave their body either out of the top of their head or out of their chest. If people are at a somewhat higher vibration than normal, and we can talk about what causes your vibration to be higher than or lower, they will often see a mist. It looks like a mist rising, and then the mist seems to disappear. I have my own radio show, and I just last night interviewed someone who had been in Vietnam, and he had been holding a soldier while he was dying, and he said he saw the mist. He described the mist to me. I said, yeah, that's common. He was surprised. He didn't realize that that's what actually you sometimes can see. But the mist just seems to us to disappear, but what's happening is that it's very rapidly rising its spiritual vibration. It reforms into you, and you feel terrific. This is, people say that the experience of leaving your body actually is physically pleasurable. Some people say it's almost orgasmic, this feeling of suddenly, but think about it. You were in a dying body. What could be worse? It's like leaving a boat anchor and suddenly being free of it. And it really feels terrific. But the problem is that you're also totally clueless because our society does not prepare us for any of this. And that's the reason, apparently, that your loved ones will come. Whoever you trust most is who they're going to send, because they'll tell you, you've got to come with us. And word of advice, go with them, because the way that we make ghosts is by trying to get the attention of the people who are upset around our bed. Oh, he's died. Oh, she's dead. What do we do? You've got to ignore them and go with those who have come for you. You can help your loved ones after you've finished the transition, but you can't. And you can't help them. If you focus on them, you just lower your own vibration to theirs, and then you no longer see the people who've come for you. And people can get stuck outside time, sometimes for centuries. And that's what we call ghosts. So we don't do that.
Okay, so I've listened to doctors and nurses who've worked in hospice care or care, you know, around people who have died or are dying, and what you're saying is what they're saying. They collaborate your research that they can tell. Yeah. They can tell when someone's going to die. And so why has this topic not been a topic of mainstream study since it really affects all of us?
It's frustrating to us because there is so much human pain that could be alleviated if scientists would stop being so stupid. But here's the situation. In the early part of the 20th century, when all of these wonderful communications were being received through deep trance mediums, there were serious researchers who were documenting. The relatives would be in the room, but there would be a researcher there who was writing down everything that was said, and they were writing books. This is what the dead are telling us. They thought they were doing cutting edge science, which they were. But this was about the same time that the scientific community was trying to deal with quantum mechanics, which was like a bomb exploded in their midst. They thought they had physics just about figured out. And suddenly, within, you know, a decade of the end of the 19th century, it was all thrown to the wind, and they were upset with that. The last thing they wanted to do was to have people ask them questions about all this stuff coming from the dead. So the gatekeepers, the university departments, the peer-reviewed journals established what they called the fundamental scientific dogma of materialism. Believe it or not, you can see it in print if you go back far enough. They won't say it now. They know how stupid it sounds. But they decided they would study only things that relate to matter. Therefore, they would not study anything that had to do with spirit or with death or anything like that. Wouldn't study it. They have enforced this to this day, even though people like Max Planck, who got the 1918 Nobel Prize as the father of quantum mechanics, he found God. I think he should get credit for having discovered what God actually is. But they ignored all that stuff that Max Planck and other early quantum physicists did, and instead just used it as a way to try to better understand matter. That's all they'll study, which is why, really, science has gone off the rails. At this point, I love Scientific American. I subscribe to it, and I read it as a humor magazine. sort of kind of tragic humor, because over and over I can see things that they can't explain, that they're talking about. Why can't they? And I can explain it, and I never took a physics course. But
this is really interesting. Okay, so explain this to me. I have a couple like weird situations that you need to explain. What happens, okay, like when I got my molars out and I was put under, you know, pain, they put you under so that you don't feel the pain. And you remember going under and then bam, you're awake again. It was like no time has passed at all, but they did surgery on you. And a lot of people think, well, is that death? Like you just don't even remember anything. What actually is occurring at that point? Like why go ahead.
You have to understand something fundamental. The only thing that exists is what human beings call consciousness. That's all that exists. Your consciousness is not produced by your brain. Your brain is nothing more than a two-way radio in the head of a meat robot. That's all it is. It picks up the signal of your mind and transmits back what your body is experiencing. But that's all the brain does. So when you sleep, routinely, your mind, because it doesn't need to sleep, but your body does, your mind will withdraw from your body and travel in the astral. We're all astral travelers. We meet with our guides. We meet with our dead loved ones. We take classes. We smoke a cigarette. I don't know. We're basically having our downtime, our fun time while our bodies sleep. So when you are put under by anesthesia or anything else, your mind bugs it out. It goes to the astral and there's no time there. And there's, because your brain cannot even comprehend any of that, very often it will create weird dreams. But that's just because it's trying to use what it has with this very limited little, you know, imagine the world's most primitive cell phone. That's about all the processing power it has. And it's trying to understand what it could not possibly understand. So it gives you strange dreams or no dreams. And where your mind was while your body was sleeping, there is no time. Time is an artifact of the material level of reality, and that's all it is. So that's why it seems like no time has passed.
Is that why we don't
actually have...
Well, why don't we ever remember anything from there?
Because it's designed that way. There is the design is that you will not remember anything that happened before you were born. It's not a perfect design. It's almost like we make a deal. We want to come into a lifetime on Earth to learn and grow. And if we took our whole mind with us, because your mind is immensely huge and powerful, and you take only a little bit of it when you come, 10 to 20% if that. And if you had to sort of deal with everything else that's gone on in your eternal life, because life is eternal, you wouldn't focus on this set of lessons. So you agree to kind of forget that stuff, and you don't remember it. It can be frustrating. I mean, I have a spirit guide who's having me do some very serious things, and it's frustrating to him that I don't remember any of the plan.
How do you know that? Did you do like some kind of... Go ahead.
This is a whole other story. Everybody has spirit guides. Everyone has a main guide, and virtually always that same person will be with us from before our birth, when we planned our lifetime, through to our death, when we review our lifetime. Sometimes we have made deals with or agreed to do things for a guide. I'm apparently more advanced, so I didn't have as many lessons to learn, although I have had a few. So I agreed with someone who was apparently a close eternal friend of mine that I would come in and do some of the things he wanted done. He didn't have to come in. I would do them. I didn't even know any of this till 2 years ago. I knew none of it. He's been guiding me to do all these things like major in religion in college. He's been guiding me to do that stuff. I had no idea. But I refused to write a book, which was a restatement of the teachings of Jesus. I refused to do that. So he broke into a reading I was having with my parents 2 years ago and basically said, this is who I am. Now get over it. And we've got work to do. He had to say basically get over it because in his next to last lifetime, he was Thomas Jefferson. And he knew I would, you know, be a groupie, which I was for a while, but I got over it. Do you wish you hadn't asked that question?
Wow. Okay. Interesting. Okay. So, because I know Thomas Jefferson did a thing with just wrote down what Jesus said, right? There's
yes,
a book that he
the
has.
The Jefferson Bible. What people don't know, and I'm not, I think they have it at Monticello, but they don't, I've never communicated with them about it. They don't know that toward the end of his life, he, with his young protege, I think involved, Richard Rush, who I also was, we wrote a book which basically took Christianity apart and said, this is what Jesus meant to do. But he never published it. He said it was too radical for the time, but now is the time to publish it. And I was saying, no way, Jose. But when he told me I had to do it, and he told me that basically this is part of raising the consciousness of the planet, it was very important to do. I did, in fact, submit to write the book, at which point I then channeled the master as well. It was a hard, let's just say 2015 was a hard year for me. A lot of things happened that I had trouble getting my mind around.
Okay, well, we're going to get back to that, but I have one more question. This is just, this is a trip for me. Okay, what happens to those little babies and things that are born deformed and they never turn out right? Is it just the person moves on to another body? I mean, is there just, you know, sometimes the biological thing is messed up, or babies that are sacrificed, I mean, or killed, you know, just weird things that so the person never has a chance to develop into anything.
That those are several questions, and they're all good ones. Why are some people born with blind, deaf, deformed in some way?
Yeah.
They choose. Nearly always, those are chosen handicaps because the person who is planning to, you know, trying to grow spiritually uses those handicaps as an opportunity for growth, or might be a very advanced being who is using those the handicaps that he or she chose to come in with as an opportunity for those around him or her to grow. It's usually not accidental. It's usually planned.
Well, how about though when a baby isn't even born, you know, stillborn and things like that?
There are several reasons why a baby would be conceived but not born. In some cases, it's a gift to the family. A stillborn child often is a gift to the family. That person went through all the trouble of, you know, doing what you have to do to become part of a body. They attach to the body, and then they left the body as a gift to the family. It's a gift helped to help them grow spiritually, or they'll die in infancy or as a young child for that reason. Not always, but. Occasionally, what happens is that someone has planned a lifetime with a certain set of circumstances in the family that they really want to experience. And then during the gestational period, those circumstances are no longer there. They decide they don't want to go through a whole lifetime when they can't learn what they wanted to come in and learn. Sometimes then they'll also be stillborn. But remember, mind is in control of all of this. We have free will while we're on Earth, and our free will is so absolute that we've actually gone very far off track on this Earth. I think we all understand that. And now very elevated beings are trying to bring us back to a bit more toward center, where we can make decisions that are not so fear-based. But I should just say one more thing. People who are fetuses that are aborted have planned a lifetime. They are, you know, they're in the womb, and someone makes a choice, and because they have free will, they can do it, that they don't want to be bothered to carry that person to term. That person does not go away. This is not a piece of tissue. Every aborted baby grows up in the afterlife, beautifully cared for, the most wonderful possible childhood and young adulthood. Doesn't take more than a few years. And when the mother dies, he or she or the father, he will find beautiful young people there, hugging them and calling them their parents. Just saying.
Wow.
So I think more people ought to be aware of that, because people might think twice about abortion. Maybe have the baby and give it away out of love.
Why don't they just leave that body and go back to the whatever world, ether world, and then go do another body? You know, like, why do they grow up in the afterlife? I don't understand.
It's a process. To be prepared to enter a body is a process. We don't know very much about it.
Okay.
I sort of think of it as a shrinkage machine. I just don't know. But we do know it's a process, And we do know that you can't enter a body without going through the process. So it's not just a quick thing. It's an important decision that you make to go through this. If you die before you, well, if you die, period, especially if you haven't grown up, you do have to go through a period of, and it's at your own pace. Some people probably do it fairly quickly. We're told it takes 3 to 5 earth years for most people, to sometimes 6 or 8, but not a whole, it takes less time than if they were here, but they do grow up to about the age of their early 20s, maybe 22 or something. And then they stop growing, because most people there, if you die at 80 here, you regress to an early age at your own pace and with your own choice. But most people there choose to be in their early 20s to late 20s.
Just such a fascinating topic. Okay, so why do people choose to be in such a horrifying existence where they're maybe abused and, you know, neglected and just, you know, raped and tortured and just awful?
Some people didn't choose that, but other people's free will put them in that situation. Some people choose to be in, especially mass, genocides and the Holocaust and all of that. Apparently, people chose to be involved in those situations, not as the perpetrators, but as the victims, as opportunities for growth. Some people apparently chose to be perhaps in a situation where they might be perpetrators, but they knew they would be able to resist being perpetrators. But of course, remember, we don't remember anything about our plan. And the people who carried out the Holocaust, not Hitler, apparently he didn't experience the worst of this, but the people who carried out the Holocaust apparently have put themselves into tremendous torment after dying and realizing, after you die, you go through, you don't get judged by anybody but yourself, and it isn't really judgment. It's more like you get to re-experience your life, not just from your own perspective, but from the perspective of everybody else that you affected. So imagine being a Holocaust, somebody who carried out the Holocaust and having to experience the suffering of all those people. You don't forgive yourself for that very easily.
Wow. Yeah. This is fascinating. So what can we learn from the dead? What do we learn from them when we study and we talk to them, apparently? What are we learning? And I suppose you're already telling us a lot, but what else?
Well, one of the things that I learned, which was one of the most profound things, it probably was the most profound afternoon of my life, because I had been such a strict Christian, you can imagine having had those experiences and then majoring, I thought I'd be a minister eventually. When I came to understand in my early 50s that no matter how hard I looked, I couldn't find any evidence that anything I had believed as a Christian was true, I went through a lot of difficult times for a couple of years. But I had read the Bible many times and was very familiar with the Gospels. I thought Jesus had said some of this stuff, but I didn't want to test him. Then one rainy afternoon, I said, I've got to get over this. So I dusted off my Bible, I opened it, and I discovered that in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Jesus had told us things about God, reality, death, the afterlife, and the meaning of our lives that we could not have confirmed in any way until we had what the dead are telling us. No way. There's no way that's a coincidence either. It is just amazing how consistent what he tells us is with what the dead tell us.
So what does he say? Give me some statements and things that
God is spirit, and we should worship in spirit and truth. He talked about weird little things. He talked about living water. He said to the woman at the well, if you knew who it is that asks you for a drink and the gift of God, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Well, the water in the afterlife levels is alive. This is one of the things many of the dead remember. It has a totally different quality from the water here. He knew that. He talked about I'm going to prepare a place for you, and then I'll come and take you to where you're going to be, where I'm going to be, and in my Father's house are many mansions. He told us all about the process of dying and the fact that when we get there, we'll all have our own little homes. On and on. He told us that we are here to learn to love perfectly and to forgive completely. That's why we're here. And he told us that if enough of us will do this, we will bring the kingdom of God on earth. We pray for it. He taught us to pray for it. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. His teachings, if we follow them, will make that happen. And he told us that. The problem we have with Christianity is that Christians believe a whole different set of things that were wrapped around these teachings. And they really don't, very few Christians don't know anything about the Gospels. They say that something about the Gospel truth is Jesus died for your sins. Jesus doesn't say that. Jesus says he came to replace religion with his teachings. He didn't come to start a new one.
So
nobody pays attention to what he says.
Who was Jesus?
Well, see, that's a very good question. I wondered about that, too. According to Thomas and those with him, Jesus is indeed unique. He's such an advanced being, even back then, that God could literally come to earth as Jesus, look through his eyes, and did that in an effort to try to figure out how giving us free will could have caused us to screw up so badly, even 2,000 years ago. And then he gave us the prescription for how to fix it, which is the teachings of Jesus. That's who Jesus was. So we are all part of God, every one of us. Our minds are part of the mind which continuously manifests this universe. So it's not that he was unique in that way, but he was unique in that God actually came to earth and personified as Jesus. Apparently,
so
it never happened again.
Very interesting. Okay, so why, if we were so messed up and we just went off the tracks, why do people keep coming here?
Because there are many places where we can learn and grow spiritually. And those places, many of them are a lot softer than here. It is rumored, this is something, one of the many things I don't know for sure, but enough of the dead have suggested that it's true, that while they go, that you can go elsewhere, you can make the most spiritual progress the fastest on earth, because there's so much negativity here. It's like going to a really tough gym. It's going to be hard and your muscles are really going to be sore, but boy, you're going to get a lot more strength than if you just pull at a rubber band at your desk, right?
So we're training for the Olympics or something here?
We're training for the spiritual Olympics, absolutely. And so that's why people want to come, because it is hard. I mean, if your life is eternal, which it is, you never begin, you never will end, then, you know, 50, 60, 70, 90, 120 years here is nothing. It's nothing, especially because we live without time most of the time. We don't even think of time as a concept. So coming here is so easy. It seems like it's just going to be like a afternoon in the gym. Then we get here, of course, we've forgotten what we're doing and who we are, and it gets a lot more complicated. But that's why we come. We want to ace this lifetime, make so much progress, we'll never have to come back.
What are animals? Like, what's your dog?
Animals, we are told, are a pure spiritual nature. And they come to earth as part of a group consciousness. So they don't feel as differentiated as we all feel. And actually, there's no separation among us. We are all one being, but we think we're separate. They don't even think they're separate. But if you love an animal and the animal loves you, it develops a separate existence, a sort of a separate identity, almost a human-like separate identity, and they're waiting for us. Every pet you've ever loved, so help me, is waiting for you there. So if you've had a lot of them that you've loved, you're going to have a whole menagerie when you get there.
So are they a separate spiritual being from
the human spiritual being? They don't need to learn and grow. We need to learn and grow. I don't understand yet why, but that's the way it is.
Okay, because they're more simple than we are, right? Are they or not? I don't understand.
Well, Jesus says, not with the eyes of man does God see. It may be that simplicity is, and he even says, unless you accept the kingdom of heaven as a little child, you'll never enter it. We're heading towards simplicity, away from complexity. It really is all simple. And the teachings of Jesus are simple. It's just that we've made it complicated with all this theology, which is wrong and which is actually appalling when you think about it.
So why you say that spiritual growth, or that no religion puts spiritual growth first? Why do they not? Why hasn't any religion figured this out?
because of, you know, they're all old. I mean, what did people know 2,000 years ago about anything? Not much. And yet Christianity, for example, it's the one I know best, Christianity is a first century religion. 2,000 years ago, it was, well, actually maybe 1,600 years ago, it was set in stone, and nothing much has changed since then. They didn't know anything then, and so now we're still, our idea is that God is stuck with who we were 1,600 years ago. That's crazy.
But do we really know anything now? I mean, because there are some pretty advanced people. Okay, I was going to say, you know, like Plato and some of the philosophers, they were thinking pretty good stuff.
They were thinking forward, and many of them had insights that were wonderful. But the trouble is, people were not ready for them. But here's a fact. Remember we talked about the only thing that exists in, is consciousness? Consciousness exists, in fact, as a range of vibrations from the lowest to the highest. And we experience the lowest as fear and other things, other negative things like hatred and anger and all of that. But fear is the lowest vibration. Love is the highest. We're here to learn how to turn from fear and go toward love. That's what spiritual growth is. It's that simple. And what does Christianity, what is it based in? Fear. It's based in fear of God, a good, you know, God-fearing. He's a good God-fearing man. And it's based in fear of a God that would put you in hell forever. And it's based in fear of Satan. It's based in, you know, fear of God. Can you imagine we teach people to fear God? What a horrible thing. God is nothing but love.
So what?
That's the problem with all religions. They all, I don't know of a single religion that doesn't teach people to be afraid. And it's, we come here to learn not to fear, to learn to get past fear and into the perfect joy of perfect love.
So what made you realize that the teachings of Jesus are a coherent system, as you say, that works to foster our spiritual growth? I mean, what is that?
I'm sorry, say that again. I want to make sure I answer it right.
Well, you say that Jesus had a coherent system that works to foster our spiritual growth. What? Well, maybe I can just ask you, what do you believe that system is? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a good answer for that. I thought that was what you were asking, but then I thought I got that wrong. When The Fun of Dying first came out in 2010, just a few months later, I was giving a talk, and in the back of all of my fun books, or all but one of them, there is a little example of a sort of a series of all the things Jesus said and what he meant and how we know what he meant from the dead. So someone raised his hand in the back of the room and he said, "So do they work?" So I said, "Does what work?" He said, "Do the teachings work?" I said, "Well, of course they do. You know what you say." Then afterwards, I thought, that's a heck of a good question. So in 2011, I began to live the teachings of Jesus, literally. And it's really simple. I learned that first you have to put gratitude in. He didn't really emphasize gratitude. Second, you've got to master perfect forgiveness. And third, love really comes naturally, but there are ways to perfect that too. And I worked at that for a couple of years, and it utterly, utterly transformed me internally. It is amazing how you wouldn't have liked me before. You really wouldn't have liked me before, but it has changed everything about my whole outlook on life. And other people who have tried the teachings say the same thing works for them, but he tells us it works. He tells us it's a system. It is a system and it does work.
That's weird. So what are some elements? It's interesting, and it's fun to talk to you about this, because it seems like there are some simple things that can really make a difference in the happiness of individuals and how we work together. But what are some elements of it that people can implement into their lives? You know, maybe even baby steps, stuff they can do to that can really transform them by just doing a few basic things.
The most important thing we can do in our lifetimes is learn to forgive. Forgiveness is something which we tend to treat as a bespoke thing. Each thing that happens that annoys you, you're going to forgive it, and then you got to go through that process. It is too hard. You can't do it. Instead, what I teach people is to do forgiveness once and for all. And what you do is you retrain your mind. Remember I said you only bring a little bit of your mind here? Well, the part you brought is primed for learning. That's why it's like you came to the gym and you put on gym shorts and a gym shirt. That's this mind. It's lazy. It follows habits, and it will easily change its habits because it's so lazy. So you used to train your mind to get very angry when the newspaper was late, or when the babysitter, you know, didn't do the dishes, or whatever it is that bugs you that you have to forgive. A lot of what we have to forgive is trivial stuff. You've taught your mind to get upset, and therefore it gives you in spades what it is you've taught it to do. So if instead, each time something is starting to upset you or you think something is going to upset you, you physically, with your arms, gather it up into a ball, nice tight ball, put the people in it, mentally, of course, and put yourself in it, and you make it a nice tight ball, and then you, with both hands, you push it away. You say, I love you, I bless you, I forgive, and I release. And that starts making your mind, if you do that every time and you never allow anything to ever upset you, but you do that with it. What that teaches your mind is not to bother. There's another trick which works, they're telling me about as well, which is with a spoon in the pocket. You take a teaspoon, you put it in your jeans pocket. Each time something annoys you, you take it out of the pocket and you put it in the other pocket. And they say that also makes your mind know not to bother. I don't know. I like the forgiveness ball technique, but boy, it works well. If you do that for even a few weeks, you'll find you stop getting, it's as if things still are on the outside being done to you, but you're peaceful now on the inside. You don't react. You don't even feel those things anymore.
It just doesn't really bother you.
Okay. It doesn't bother you.
So do most people, have they been here before? Or is this the first time for a lot of people?
This is almost always one of many, 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 many lifetimes we've lived. I don't know the total number, but it's in probably the hundreds for most of us. It doesn't need to be. Everybody listening now, I don't care how old you are, as long as you're still healthy, you have the ability to make this your last lifetime. It's not hard. It's just that we haven't known why we were here, so we had to learn everything the hard way. My guide, Thomas, tells me he and I have had 17 lifetimes together. So that's just with one other person.
Do you tend to have lifetimes with the same people?
Yes. It's called, we're called soul groups. And it's easier to learn that way. You know, we these are eternal friends, eternal comrades. And we don't always come into the same lifetimes together, but often we do. Or I might guide him, or he might guide me, and other friends of ours might be there or not there. I know in my own lifetime, for example, I've been told that my birth family is not part of my soul group, but I needed for what Thomas and I were going to do together to be born in that time and place. And so that was a ready body, so I took it. But there are other people in my life that I know I have had lifetimes with before. You recognize it almost immediately when you know, people you really click with. Those are probably people you've had a lifetime with, or two or 10 or 100 in the past.
Oh, that's really interesting. So how do you know, is there a process you can go through to figure out what lifetimes you might have lived in the past, like who you actually were?
There are people who do readings, yes. Usually it's done under hypnosis, and you're brought back to a specific historical period or to the lifetime that's influencing you the most. One of the things they use it for is getting rid of phobias. For example, you're afraid of heights. You know, go to the lifetime when you develop that fear of heights. I cured myself of a fear of heights when I was just reading about this stuff about, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. I had a crippling fear of stepping off an edge. And then I said to myself, I wonder if that comes from the past. Didn't think about it again, but I started to get flashes of being this young Native American boy, about 18, 16 or something, standing on the edge of a cliff, and it's early, early morning, and I know I can fly. And when what kept popping into my mind, I said, oh my goodness, I'll bet that little idiot actually stepped off the edge. And as soon as you realize where the fear comes from, it goes away. a few months later, we were visiting people in New York on the umpteenth floor of a big building downtown, like 40-something floor. And normally I couldn't even be in a building that tall, but I went in, and they had the windows open because it was Sunday. And I could see the Chrysler building, and I went and I almost leaned out the window to look at the Chrysler building. And I turned and my husband was standing with his mouth open at the doorway to that room. And only then did I realize I wasn't afraid of heights anymore. That's how amazing it is. If someone has a phobia that's crippling, for heaven's sake, find a good regression therapist because they can help you get rid of it in one session.
Wow. Okay. So there's been a lot of research into the past human development, and they're finding pyramids and stuff all over the world that's pointing to the fact that the human race is much, much older than we thought it was, and that maybe in the past we were much more spiritually developed. Could we, what they're seeing is there is probably a cataclysm that wiped us out, and then we are very basic again, and then we're rebuilding civilization up. That's a lot of the theories right now. And based on the aging of all these artifacts, have you thought about that, or has any of that entered into your research, talking to the dead or connecting that to what you're learning?
No, it's not been an area of interest, nor has the extraterrestrial stuff been a matter of interest, but it does come up, especially as extraterrestrials, because they are very much involved with the Earth now, trying to protect us from destroying ourselves. So if I come across it in situations like that, then I study it a little bit. But my goal is to try to understand and then help people to know what to do to live a perfect life here, so you don't have to come back.
Well, but are the
so much fun there?
Well, but what are the ETs? Us, just from another? I mean, what the heck are they then?
We are all of the same consciousness, which is the only consciousness that exists.
They're just from a different place.
They have chosen to do their evolution in different bodies, and some of them are already perfected. For example, the race of Arcturians, apparently, and again, here's the area where I'm not an expert, but I'm told that the race of Arcturians have so perfected themselves that their planet is empty now. They basically, everybody graduated, and they are in what we think of as the afterlife dimensions or the astral dimensions, but they have become the guardians of the Earth, because we produce so much negativity that we can literally be milked for negativity by negative entities. They can feed off the hatred, anger, fear, war, all this crap going on now.
Yeah, we're a pretty negative species. Now that
right.
is fact.
We were not always this way, and we are turning it around. They're because people like my guide, Thomas, is part of a very large group of thousands of beings, including Jesus and all of his people, who are working to raise the consciousness of the planet. This has been going on for, I think, about 100 years, and they're making progress. Now, you can't see it, but I can, because when I go and give talks, it used, even 5-6 years ago, people were not as aware as they are now. I'll bet more and more people are listening to you and listening. I mean, I think something like a million people who listen to me now, because people want to know. And just the fact that they want to know is the start of making this work. If as few as 10% of people would materially raise their consciousness now, that would affect everybody else on the face of the Earth, because we're all one being. Our consciousness is not differentiated. We're all one.
Yeah, this is just absolutely amazing. I'd love to hear what we were in the past, you know, like because a lot of what they're saying is that we were spiritually higher, and that we regressed, the planet regressed. But I don't know, I guess that's another talk, and it's another thing that we can dive into.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question before about Atlantis and all of, I think that those things have happened in the past. I'm not sure that the planet as a whole was more advanced, but there are some very advanced civilizations that apparently have disappeared almost without a trace, except that they'll linger in myths and all of that, and then we sort of begin again. And between you and me, based on what Thomas tells me, we have a real risk of a couple of hundred years from now doing the same with this civilization.
Why?
And starting all over. because of all the negativity. That's why they're working so hard to raise the consciousness of the planet.
Oh, so the negativity takes it. We destroy ourselves through negativity.
This is, I'm going to tell you what he said was the reason I had to write Liberating Jesus. We are going downhill so rapidly toward the negative end of the debasement of the planet that he said in 200 years, things are going to be so bad that the Christians, what he calls the so-called Christians, are going to start a religious war, which will wipe everything out if we don't stop it. So it's his particular quest, this man who, even when he was alive as Thomas Jefferson, he was adamantly not a traditional Christian. He believed, he followed Jesus, and he believed in God, but he didn't think Christianity was worth it, anything. He said that the words of Jesus stand out in the Bible like diamonds in a dunghill, so that's about what he thought of the rest of the Bible. But what he says is the religion can become a cancer on the earth if we don't turn it toward what Jesus came to do. How did he put it? He said, the corruption of all the master taught continues. And this is the blockage through which peace must flow. Hearts are not free. And he said, once we destroy that blockage, we will be able to then, in the most glorious way possible, bring the kingdom of God on earth, which is what Jesus came to do in the beginning. All we have to do is follow the teachings of Jesus.
This is incredible.
Why would Christians want to do that? Yes, it is.
Well, I just think what you're doing is incredible. You believe it so. I mean, you were, there's like no doubt in your mind. You are just so, I can see why you have a million people that listen to you, because, and what you're saying, it's like, oh, wow. I mean, it's just incredible. And then when I went, I listened to some of your talks, and then I went and I listened to some nurses and doctors, and they were saying everything that you were saying. It was incredible. I mean, I don't know what I think. It's a disruption for me. It's a paradigm shift. And I'm,
why?
I'm like,
you didn't believe this before?
No. It's just every time I get something that's like, wow, you know, what a different way. It's not that I didn't believe it. I tend to be a really positive person overall. It's just such, I've never heard this before. You are introducing me to a new way of I just not to this level. Do you know what I mean? And I've been trying to read and listen to, it's a new paradigm to this degree. And to,
I'm delighted to send you as many books as you'd like and to help you in any way you can, because you can be a powerful voice to help open people's minds and hearts to the truth, because this is all true.
Well, it's the just fact incredible that, way of looking
think about where we are. We're stuck between religions, which are closed to the truth, and science, which until we've shamed them into it, is going to be also closed to the truth. What's going to open the minds of science is there's very good work being done in the area of communication. We think it's even possible that within 5 years you'll have an app on your phone that'll let you call up Aunt Mildred and get her their recipe, and she died 100 years ago. That's in the works.
That's just incredible. I want to talk to whoever's doing that and how they're doing it. I just think this. Well, science is the study of truth and what is. So science should not,
you know,
close
not.
It up.
Science is the truth of matter.
No,
it's,
I know. I know. I know. But
it.
What it should be is the truth
I
of
know.
What is. I know what
yes.
you're saying. And so it's, you know, it should open itself up to looking at things from a much broader perspective, but it has to be about the truth. It can't be made up stuff. It has to be, there has to
it
be
has
factual.
To be about the truth.
Yeah.
Yes. That's the problem people have. They don't understand how much evidence there is. And it isn't just that there's a lot of it. It's that it all fits together. I mean, I've been doing this for 50 years, close to, and it wasn't really until the last 10 years that I was as certain as I am now, because I'm a skeptic by nature. I know I found true stuff. I don't want to fit anything into this scheme that is not true, because it's going to screw up the painting, you know? It has to be perfectly true. And only things that perfectly fit will we use. But we have enough understanding now, we who have studied reality, which is what nobody else does, we have enough understanding of what's going on to be pretty confident that everything I'm telling you today is true. And notice how it all fits and makes sense.
Well, that's when you know something is true, is because it just
it
easily slides into place versus having to cram it in.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes.
So how can people learn more about you? You have your own radio show. You have all these things. You have a million people, which is going to be growing, I can tell. How can people get a hold of you and learn about you? And
my website is robertagrimes.com. You can contact me through, there's a contact block on the website. My radio program is called Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. And Seek Reality, obviously, is what I'm trying to do, and we all should be doing.
How can people hear that? Is it on, just on the internet, or do you actually air?
It's on BBM Global Network at 7 o'clock on, I think it's bbmglobalnetwork.com, at 7 o'clock on Thursday evenings, Eastern Time. But it's also available on iTunes. It's on webtalkradio.net, and it's on a couple of other outlets as well that you air, because I've been doing this for almost 4 years. They air older episodes, and they love my guests. I have the best guests on earth, and there a lot of them are people who work in this field that you've never heard of, but history will definitely record them in the history books. This is all going to break wide open. It's going to break open soon. Oh, and if people want to know how to, you know, the easiest way probably to find my podcast is on iTunes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and I really appreciate it.
I'm so glad to have been here. You're such a terrific interviewer. You just let me get all excited and talk and stuff, and you're very, very nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. As Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.